Hi, this is Lisa Johnson Pratt, and welcome to this episode of Life After Abuse. On this episode, I'll be talking with renowned attorney Eric McLeish. Eric is well known for representing victims of sexual abuse. He gained substantial prominence after representing hundreds of victims in the Boston area during the Catholic priest sexual abuse scandal. This abuse scandal riveted our nation for over 2 years as this information came to light and was chronicled in the Boston Globe. Since then, Eric has continued to fight for victims, many of whom have been betrayed by trusted institutions. Eric has been recognized as one of the top trial lawyers in the U.S. and has received numerous awards for his work, including the Champion for Justice Award from the National Crime Victims Bar Association. What I really want to do is just kind of jump right into the conversation. And, you know, first of all, thank you very much for coming to talk to me on Life After Abuse. And I'd like to just kind of start off by making a statement which I don't think can be disputed. And that is that you're really one of the most storied attorneys fighting on behalf of sexual abuse victims. It's really quite impressive. And so what I wanted to know is if you could tell me a little bit more about how you came to this field, how you came to this area, and how you came to represent, you know, hundreds of victims, first with a Catholic Church sexual abuse case in Boston, but then also, you know, fighting on behalf of others who have been abused. And that would be great.
I went to a boarding school called St. George's in Newport, Rhode Island, and my first involvement in sexual abuse cases occurred in 1989 when a woman came in to see me and asked if I could represent her in a sexual abuse case. She was extremely fearful. She was reluctant to meet with me. There were not that many cases of this kind that had ever been brought. And I asked her to tell me the story. And I, you know, wasn't quite sure how to handle this. I tried to be compassionate and sensitive. She was very reluctant to give me details, such as places and names. She didn't tell me where she'd gone to school. At the end, I asked, and she told me it was the school that I'd gone to, St. George's. And I had to tell her that I'd gone to the school. And she said, oh, you won't be able to represent me. I've gone through all of this. And I said, no, I'd be delighted to represent you. I got kicked out of the school. And it turned out that the person who had abused her was someone who I knew when I'd gone to boarding school, who was the athletic trainer, Al Gibbs. And he was always regarded by the students as a very, very strange guy, exceptionally close to the kids. Always wanted to close the locker room when he was massaging you and pull down the blinds in his trainer's office. But the real molestation started several years after I left when girls arrived at the school. We now know that approximately one-third of all the girls that attended that school for 10 years were molested by Al Gibbs. And those are just the ones that came forward. But of course, the school wasn't interested back in 1989 in having any of this exposed. So we filed a lawsuit. They fought tooth and nail to prevent the case from going anywhere. They really tried to terrorize the student, Anne, who, you know, had a wonderful family, and they tried to terrorize her family as well. And, you know, you can use terror tactics in litigation, and they tried to do that. And they blamed the abuse on other people, and they were subpoenaing their neighbors, and finally Anne just decided she'd had enough of it. And she just walked away from it. So it was really kind of a very disappointing and unfortunate introduction into sexual abuse litigation. I was by no means someone who won every case, but I did, you know, I was used to prevailing in most of them. And this was one where the plaintiff was so upset about the process that she just walked away, which is ironic because then, you know, almost, you know, 30 years later, we come back and take on St. George's again. But it wasn't until 2015 that Ann and I reconnected and then took on St. George's, and it ended up with me representing 35 people. But that's how I started. That's how I started with that case.
And so in terms of the Boston case, because I'm sure that there are going to be some people who are going to recognize your name from that, how did that get started? And because that really changed the trajectory of probably your career, but also, you know, the Catholic Church. Talk to us about that, because before then, there had been no one who was going to the media saying, you need to do something about this.
Right, and it wasn't just the news media, too. It was also litigation. I mean, the backdrop to the Boston priest abuse litigation, which was really you know, it was the epicenter of all priest abuse center cases. It was the first time a very, very large case had been brought. We represented in that case, including people from other religious orders, close to 400 individuals had been molested by priests. We had 8 lawyers working on the case full time. We had a team of paralegals, administrative assistants. We had a full-time social worker that we paid for out of our own pockets, whose job was just to try to get treatment to our clients. We were at some points of like a triage in an emergency room trying to keep people alive. But we had good clinicians who were working for us and some who were volunteering. But the backdrop to that case was actually, for those of you who've seen the movie Spotlight, about 9 years earlier, I had represented a group of 100 individuals who'd been molested by a priest by the name of James Porter down in Fall River. And I was told by my administrative assistant that I had to go over and meet with 6 people who claimed that they'd been abused. This is in 1991. And I said, look, I'm done doing mental health pro bono work. I don't believe something like that could ever happen. Well, I went over and met with them because I always did everything that my assistant told me to do. And I was absolutely blown away that these were people, there was no doubt on what had happened to them. The principal, you know, the leader in this group had just taken out an ad saying, remember Father Porter, and he had 5 other people contact him, both men and women. The case rapidly expanded up to about 102 individuals that I represented in that case. But at the end of it, and the Boston Globe did a great job covering it, but at the end of it, I got a call from Matt Storen, the editor of the Globe, saying there will be no more priest abuse stories. And I learned that Cardinal Law, who was sort of the principal bad guy in the Boston priest abuse cases, had called up Bill Taylor, the publisher of the Globe, and said, we're going to, you know, ask our readers to withhold their advertising if you keep publishing these stories about priests abusing young people. So they did, you know, and so the Boston Globe put a kibosh on this for 7 years, as that's actually acknowledged in the movie. The Globe came to me, Walter Robinson, the chief of the Spotlight team, came to me in 2001 and asked if I'd be willing to get back into the cases. And I said, I don't really, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. Your own newspaper said that they weren't interested. And he said, don't worry, we'll get you all the clients you need. And so basically the Boston Globe referred me business. The Boston Globe put my name on the front page when they did their first article. They put my name on, you know, many, many front page articles in the Boston Globe, even though before I had any clients. So I rapidly began to get clients. We were very aggressively litigating that case. There were extreme challenges in litigating it because of the statute of limitations. But I think one thing that we recognized was that we were not going to get anywhere without the news media. That it was really going to be the news media, and particularly the Boston Globe, that was going to make the change here, because the legal remedies were really, you know, quite, they were quite stretched. You had very difficult case law on the statute of limitations. It was basically 3 years. You have this horrible law that limited liability against any religious organization to $20,000, which is just one of the most extraordinary pieces of laws you'd ever imagine. But we knew we were going to be in for a tough fight. So while we litigated the case aggressively, the Globe made a deal with me. We'll refer you cases if you give us the documents you get in discovery. And I said, okay. And I honored that request. So, for example, some of the first rounds of documents we got, so-called religious documents, a reference, just to take one person, Reverend Paul Shanley, and the Boston Archdiocese and Cardinal Law had in their secret archival files a letter from a fellow in New York reporting that Reverend Shanley had been at the founding meeting of the North American Man-Boy Love Association and had been openly advocating for sex between men and boys. Well, what had the Archdiocese done in response to that? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. So there were documents that we were able to obtain and deposition testimony that we took. It took 9 days of Cardinal Law's deposition. And there was information that came out through that was just, it was beyond belief. It was so extraordinary that if anyone had told me about it in advance, I would have told them this can't possibly be true. Because what we know now is that everything was very, very well documented, that there were massive numbers of complaints about priests abusing children, that it had all been hidden, it had all been put in these secret archival files. We had to go to the state Supreme Court to get them, but we did end up getting them. We got files on 175 different priests. And what they had done to boys and girls in parishes throughout Boston, and how the Archdiocese had treated those complaints, which was mostly by transferring the priest over to the next diocese, not the next diocese, the next parish, and putting him in the position where he could do it again. It was just beyond belief. It was just simply something that we couldn't fathom. So we were very aggressive about that. And one of the fortunate things was that the Archdiocese was so incompetent that they delayed getting us the files. And when they got them, they generally only give us one at a time, or two different priest files at a time. So we were able to have continuous front page news stories in the Boston Globe, each one seemingly more outrageous than the last one. And it just kept all of this in the public consciousness to the point where there was just no denying it. I mean, there was no denying the cover-up. There was no denying what had happened. These were their files. They were not documents. They were prepared by the plaintiffs, by the people who had been abused. This was prepared by the Archdiocese of Boston. And it's amazing because it's all chronicled right now on a website called Bishop's Accountability, which has expanded to chronicle documents like this from all over the country. But it was really historic. These documents, as frightening and as horrifying as they were just a very compelling piece of history, showing what was going through the minds of these religious leaders who were faced with this crisis of these men sexually abusing children, and how did they respond. And it's just, it's beyond belief. I still can't believe it.
One of the things that I've been really wondering about is, you know, what you learned around societal attitudes regarding sexual abuse. There are some things that are happening around the edges. You know, there's a Violence Against Women's Act, which we'll talk about, you know, in another podcast. But what I'm not seeing is this sort of acknowledgement, especially on things like college campuses, where, you know, we have these horrific statistics. I don't see any changes by administrators. So,
in fact, what you see on college campuses is a tightening of the rules under Title IX, which is going to make it easier for perpetrators to evade legal and disciplinary responsibility. I mean, you know, that whole reversal of some of the Obama-era policies is really frightening to me. And it's now almost like before you're going to be able to remove someone from a campus who's a predator, you have to really prove your case by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, it's not quite like that, but it's like a trial. And there's this whole other movement now that you're seeing of, you know, sort of people who are arguing that this has gone too far, Me Too's gone too far, and the real victims in this are the perpetrators. And you see people like Alan Dershowitz, you know, a famous former civil libertarian, who's kind of at the forefront of that, who's leading the charge for it. So it's almost like the presumption now, and you saw it, I think, with Brett Kavanaugh too, the presumption now is that these people are being falsely accused. And yet we know, because this has been studied, you know, in a way that is, that is scientific as it possibly can be, that we know that 90% of the people that come forward with allegations are not making it up. But, you know, it's inevitable to me that there would be a pushback on this, but I didn't think it would go quite this far. And, you know, it's certainly scary that victims no longer feel that they can come out to a friendly environment. If they're celebrities, if they're people that are well known, then maybe yes. But ordinary people, no. I don't think that it's much easier to come forward and get justice now than it was, you know, before Me Too.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, that's like really concerning, right? Because that's the dominant group of people that's being harmed are just, quote, your regular people, right? These are the girls who are just trying to get through high school or just trying to get through college. And it's very disturbing to me that, you know, some high profile cases where there, you know, was not abuse, like the Duke LaCrosse case, gets held up as the norm. When in fact we know that's not the norm.
I would disagree with you a little bit about that case. I think there was some very bad lawyering that went on in that case, and some maybe very good lawyering by the. That's not so clear to me what happened. What's clear to me is that something did happen. But yeah, right. The kind of the way that we think of the Duke LaCrosse case is that those boys were vindicated. I'm not so sure I agree with that.
That's very helpful. So what did you learn about victims of sexual abuse as you've gone through that? We talk about victims, first of all, as if they're a monolithic group. Obviously, they're not. And then there are younger victims or people who've had more recent experiences. And then there are people who've been living with this for decades, right? But in terms of the people who came forward to you and said, I want to go after my perpetrator, who are these people? What sets them apart that says, I'm going to go fight for this, fight for my rights?
Well, there are all kinds of different people. And the one thing you can really say is that you can't stereotype victims of abuse. They can come from all professional backgrounds. They can be CEOs of big companies. They can be homeless people. Like, one of the things that I would say that most of them have in common is that they are people that do not want to be under the authority of anybody else ever again, because they were under the authority and control of people at one point in time, and they had no power, and terrible things happened to them. Apart from that, though, they're just very different. You cannot make any stereotypical judgments about who these folks are. This is not, sexual abuse is not a crime that is perpetrated only against women. It also includes men. Maybe not to the same extent. We don't really have hard, good data on that. We can't make any socioeconomic statements. It could be people from across the socioeconomic spectrum. I think that in terms of the people, just the people that I represent that have come forward, you see some people who are prepared to be, you know, very much leaders in any sort of movement that around a particular individual or around a religious organization. People who are very comfortable in that role. And then you see people who are not very comfortable in that role, that want to be in the shadows, that don't want to be leaders. I think in terms of outcomes, I think when people come forward, I think that there are different outcomes for them. We lost 4 people to suicide in our cases involving the Boston Archdiocese, which was absolutely tragic. None of us, I think, ever got over that. So some people, I think, can be helped when they, quote unquote, come forward. Others can't be. Some people, when they come forward, they are very comfortable being in the limelight. But you know something, Lisa, is after a while the limelight ends. I mean, if you take a look at actually the priest abuse cases in Me Too, it survived being at the forefront of the media for a long, long time. I mean, the priest abuse cases in Boston, the media coverage went on consistently, you know, for 2.5 years, front page story after front page story. But eventually the journalists, you know, have to move on to other things. It's like at private schools right now, there was a series of articles in the Boston Globe and then the New York Times starting in 2016 that lasted for about 1.5 years. But inevitably, journalists have to move on. So it can sometimes be very hard for victims when the people that they were on a first name basis with, you know, their friends at the Boston Globe no longer return their telephone calls. So what I try to tell people up front is that they have to take care and protect themselves. I highly recommend people getting therapy while they're doing this. You know, not everybody wants to do that because, after all, you know, they would have to trust a therapist, and trust is very, very difficult for people. For many people who've been in trusting relationships before, and those were exploited and abused. You need as much support as you possibly can get. I mean, you're also talking about a group of people, many of whom have never, ever told anybody about this.
Yeah.
And there's a variety of reasons for that. I mean, it could be shame. It's often shame. It could be guilt. It could be fear of how the family will react. So you've got people who have lived with this terrible, terrible dark secret in many situations. And my team are like the first people they're talking to about it. And that, of course, puts us in it's really not about us, but it puts us in the position of really wanting to make sure that our clients are taken care of and that they get therapy. I would say that of the people that I've represented over the years, most have done pretty well and still feel pretty good right now about what they did. You know, that they were, they're not necessarily, you know, 100% better by any stretch of the imagination. But they went through a process that resulted in giving them a voice, sometimes giving them money, which made their lives a little bit easier. But they did something. You know, they did something. They didn't just suffer with a secret inside. So I think that generally most people do well, but others don't. I mean, it's just you can't really tell. And that's a risk we talk to people about as well. Yeah. I mean, if you come forward and do this, you know, you may be in the minority, but in that minority of people that don't really do well as of an outcome at the end of this and aren't really able to move on. And it creates challenges for us as lawyers, too, to make sure we have proper boundaries. Because, of course, we have feelings, lots of feelings about this stuff. But we're lawyers. We're not people who can necessarily, you know, provide, or we can't provide all the services that our clients need. And we can't pretend that we're going to be able to save everybody. We'd like to, but we're not clinicians. We're not professionals. So we have to be cognizant of that too, and draw, you know, proper boundaries with our clients, and make sure that people who are really skilled, who treat trauma victims, trauma-informed clinicians, can help our clients. And you know, what's one of the things that's been interesting, and I think really positive in what some people would say is a pretty dismal picture, is that right now, when we go to a school or a diocese and we say, look, we've got this client who was sexually abused by either father so-and-so or by teacher so-and-so, and we'd like you to pay for therapy. You know, forget about whether there's going to be a case here. We'd like you to make a commitment right here, right now, that my client can go out and get a therapist, a good trauma-informed therapist, and you're going to pay, you know, for the next 3 years. And it's surprising that right now that's kind of accepted. So that's a good thing. That organizations, even without legal liability, often recognize that, you know, they really have to come step up to the plate and pay for therapy. That's positive. Does it happen always? No. But you know, you have to be happy about some of the good things that are occurring. I think that's one of them.
Yeah, that's a really great point, and I appreciate that. I guess the question that's probably on a listener's mind is, when actually should you reach out to an attorney? And then what, you know, two or three things should they expect if they come to talk to you? You talked a little bit about some of the, you know, support services that they're going to need that you really can't provide, you know, and that's not in your remit. But what should they expect from you and your team?
Well, I think the most important thing that they need to look at, first of all, as well as the lawyer, is there the potential for criminal prosecution? You know, we've had a lot of changes in the statute of limitations. We just had a change in the statute of limitations in New York, both on the criminal and the civil side. And so is there the potential for criminal prosecution? If there is the potential for a criminal prosecution, then they have to ask whether or not they're interested in being part of that. You know, that's also a major commitment, can involve, you know, a lot of the trauma of coming forward against a perpetrator. And I always tell people, you know, this is an option for you. It's not your job to go to the DA's office and help them with the case. But if you would like to, let me tell you what's going to be involved, and let me tell you what we can't do, because that's very important. If we're going to go forward with going to the police, what we can't do is file a lawsuit for money damages. Because what happens is that the perpetrator will use that as a strong defense in any case, basically saying, this person is filing a criminal case against me only because they want money. Mm-hmm. So, and there have been some terrible errors that have been committed recently by lawyers who have made announcements that they're representing a client in a civil case for money damages while there's a pending criminal prosecution. And that happened, for example, in the Kevin Spacey case. That was really, really unfortunate. So you kind of have to make a choice up front. You know, am I going to go down the criminal route? Is it a possibility? And if so, you know, I've got to be prepared to put the civil remedies, money damages, kind of on a back burner. And also, I have to put on a back burner talking to the news media, you know, mm-hmm. because no DA is going to want you talking to the news media. They're going to want you talking in court. Then and it's many, many, many times, unfortunately, the criminal remedy is not possible. The statute of limitations can be changed retroactively on the civil side, but it cannot be changed retroactively on the criminal side, unfortunately. So I would say most of the cases that we have, there's no possibility of prosecuting somebody. The statute of limitations is gone, which is one of the hardest things to tell the client. There's nothing you can do. You know, it would be unconstitutional, can't be prosecuted. DA is not going to do it. So then you move on to the civil side. You need to look at, well, what are my goals? Is it just to get money? And there's nothing wrong with doing that. Money can make your life a little bit easier, you know, and many of these institutions can afford to make your life a little bit easier. And is that something I'm interested in? You know, what are my goals? What are my priorities? You may want to speak out publicly. Because this has happened repeatedly with the same person, because there's, you know, your voice wants to be heard. Is this something you want to do? Is it sometimes easier if you're an adult to speak out than it is if you're a child? We find that many of our adolescent clients or people who are young adults are very reluctant to speak out because they're going to see their name potentially in the newspaper, and it's going to affect their career, and it's going to be on the internet. So that's why. It's actually quite rare for adolescents, young adults, to speak out publicly. So those are the kind of things you have to look at, sort of what are your priorities. It's very important that the lawyers recognize that this is not about them. You know, this is about their clients. And they're there to effectuate the goals of their clients. They're not there to make news themselves. I mean, sometimes that can be helpful. Sometimes they can facilitate giving their clients a voice, but they can't become the second character, the central characters. I think that's unfortunate that some lawyers have really put themselves, you know, ahead of the interests of their clients in that way. You are there to help your client. So that's something that you've got to figure out. What are my goals? What are my priorities? What do I want to do? Is this lawyer someone I think I can work with? You know, and that doesn't mean that the lawyer has to be their best friend. That's, in fact, often a problem. But they need to understand what the lawyer can do, and, you know, but they're not going to be there to take calls in the middle of the night unless there are emergencies. They're not there to treat them. They're not qualified to do that. So good boundaries from a lawyer is something that's very important. And, you know, then it's just a question of finding the right fit, finding someone you feel you can get along with.
Right. And so, Eric, you also have a co-mediation practice, right? Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I do think that a lot of times people come in, they talk to a lawyer, and then they think, okay, well, first we're going to court. And then you're like, nope, you're probably not going to go to court if that's not part of your priorities and goals. Okay. So then what is this mediation piece, and what do you do in that?
Okay. Well, let me talk about mediation in general. First of all. Mediation is used commonly in the cases that we have, and it's a way of resolving disputes that does not involve going to court. It does not resolve criminal cases, only civil cases. But let's say you've got your goal is not just to get money, but you want to see the policies and procedures of the institution that you went to where the abuse occurred. You want to see them reformed. So one of the things that is very, very effective, it's effective between 80 and 90% of the time, is for your lawyer, hopefully in conjunction with the other lawyer, well, it has to be in conjunction with a lawyer on the other side, picking a neutral, as we say, someone who's had a lot of experience dealing with sexual abuse. It could be a former judge, although some of the best neutral mediators are people who are not former judges, but people who were, some of them defense lawyers, some of them plaintiff's lawyers. And so basically you present your case, typically after a forensic evaluation from a psychologist who documents the injuries and the damages. You present your case in a 1 or 2 day session to the mediator. And the mediator has no power. The mediator can't decide. What the mediator can do is sort of transmit messages back and forth that, you know, litigants ordinarily would be very reluctant to transmit back and forth directly. So it's a way of short-circuiting the process. I've settled many, many hundreds of cases in the last 2 years. Through mediation. It is an ideal process. There's a cadre of about 5 or 6 mediators in Boston, which is kind of a national hub for mediation, where mediation is done, cases all over the country. I do cases all over the country. And it's a really ideal victim-friendly process. No one gets cross-examined. The client shows up with a lawyer, with perhaps a psychological expert, but that's it. The first thing out of the institution's, you know, mouth is, I'm sorry, we're sorry. You know, there's no cross-examination. No one is questioning, you know, what happened here. I mean, that requires that the lawyers do their due diligence too and make sure that the claims are going to be credible. But I've never had any school or any institution of any kind in a sex abuse case say to my client, look, we really don't believe you, or even question their credibility. Now, that's very different from litigation, where the whole process is to question the credibility of the client. So this is a very cost-effective, it's a extremely relatively quick way of resolving disputes. And I've also seen it do, it's not true in every case, certainly not true in all cases, but I've seen, under the proper circumstances, with the right people there, positive things happening for the client. You know, when the client hears those words, you know, I'm truly sorry for what happened. Of course, it's always qualified by the fact that I wasn't here at the time. that's made a difference. In some cases, not all cases, it can be, because everything's different, everybody's different. But it's definitely something that's worthwhile doing. I've really had to stop with my wife doing co-mediation work. She's a mental health professional, and we still do a little bit of it, but I'm just too overwhelmed with cases to really spend much of my time focusing on mediation. And there are a lot of good mediators out there, a lot of good mediators. So it's definitely a worthwhile process, success rate of between 80 and 90%, and something that people ought to consider.
So Eric, thanks a lot for this. What I'd like to do is close with four questions that I ask everyone. And answer can be as short or as long as you want. But the first question is, what one thing would you like for victims of abuse or assault to know?
Okay. The answer to that is that the process sounds scary. People watch television. They see, you know, Law and Order being put up on the stand and grilled. It doesn't have to be that way. On the civil side, it can be something that is relatively, I mean, I'm not going to say it's painless, because it is painful, but it can be something that can be positive. It can be something that gets resolved quickly and without a lot of psychological injury. And it's not going to be something that's going to, you know, in most cases, dramatically change your life, although I've had plenty of cases where it has, financially. But it can make your life a little bit better, and sometimes a lot better, and enable you to do things and give up your day job and go out and write a book, for example. Or be with your family more. So it's something that can be very, very positive.
Second question, what one thing would you encourage victims of abuse or assault to do?
I think that the one thing I would encourage them to do is to sit down with an objective person, which may not be a family member, and consider what their options are, and to make it clear to that lawyer that they are in charge of this process. Not the lawyer, nobody else. They need to take control of, you know, what's happened. And for many years, they, of course, they had no control. And so now it's their turn to have control. So sit down and consider, you know, with someone who's experienced, what are your options?
Question three, please name one thing that we as a society should be doing to stop abuse and assault.
Well, one thing that we can certainly do is to simply get rid of all of those stereotypical notions we have about how sex abuse victims should behave, because there's no, you know, there's sometimes people behave after they've been abused in ways that some people don't consider to be, quote, normal or consistent with their uninformed views about how abuse victims should behave. And then if there's media coverage, it starts to roll into this big thing of false memories, false accusations, you know, people are being subject to a witch hunt. That's the one thing that I really wish people would understand, is that you cannot take your stereotypical notions about how an abuse victim should behave and then apply it to a given situation, because you know nothing. You know absolutely nothing. So that's one thing I think that we can do. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that we can do nationally in terms of legislation. We could certainly expand reporting requirements for schools. Right now, one of the things that we don't do well enough is have reporting requirements for peer-on-peer sexual abuse and harassment in public and private high schools. That's exempted. It has to be a teacher or an educational professional who's involved in the abuse. I mean, there's a lot of legislation we can pass as well. But those are the two things that stand out to me.
Terrific. And last question. What is the most important thing we should be doing to help support victims, or help support the victims, and why?
Well, we need, it's like everything else. I mean, if we can support victims, you just take a look at it from the most selfish standpoint. And if we can support treatment options for victims and provide, you know, proper therapy, sometimes, you know, that's not going to be covered by your, you know, insurance plan, but proper therapy from trauma-informed therapists, you're going to take people who are going to suffer significantly in their lives and turn their lives around significantly. And I think like so many other things in life, unless it's happened to you, that's not a priority. But certainly an investment of dollars into more trauma-informed therapists, into legislation that would require trauma-informed therapists treating individuals who've been sexually abused. You know, a lot of this could come down to money, dollars, and treatment. So that I think is something that would be a high priority for me.
Eric, I really want to thank you very much for coming on Life After Abuse and talking to me about this super important issue. I think you've given us a lot of great food for thought. And again, really appreciate it. So thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me, Lisa.
After the assault of a loved one, it's often very chaotic. The most important thing that I did was to ensure that my daughters had the medical and psychological support that they needed to heal from the initial trauma and to stem the potential for longer lasting damage. That being said, I believe that it's critical to seek legal remedy, whether that is via the civil or criminal route or both. In future episodes, we'll talk more with trauma experts, but suffice it to say that with trauma and abuse, the brain has suffered a serious blow. The brain and often the body will need to recover. There is no one route to recovery, and every patient will be different. Some victims will be able to get back to their lives quickly with good supportive care, while others may take decades, even with excellent care. With sexual assault and abuse, there may be long-term negative implications on schooling, work, relationships, and activities of daily living. Behavioral health care is very varied depending on where one lives and sometimes requires substantial out-of-pocket payments for the best practitioners. A legal remedy may provide the financial support for care that may need to last for years. If you or a loved one has been abused, please strongly consider a consultation with an attorney. Thanks for listening to this episode of Life After Abuse. Until next time, do one thing to support female abuse victims. Remember, they are counting on us. If you want to find out more about Life After Abuse or would like to be interviewed, please visit the website lifeafterabusepod.com. That's lifeafterabusepod.com. Take care and be well.